Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. This is the second episode in a row featuring poems about work. The previous show focused on manual labor. This one has much more to say about desk jobs. Did you ever have a job that you abruptly quit soon after it began? Why did you do that? The first three lines of our first poem, Dorian Locke's What I Wouldn't Do, refer to a job the speaker quit after just one shift. The job the speaker abandoned so quickly? Phone solicitation work. Yes, Locke's defines an era of telemarketers we hope will soon be obliterated. So the opening three lines refer to the job she abruptly quit, and then she does not return to explain why she quit until the poem's closing. For most of the poem, the speaker details six other jobs she performed. This is Dorian Locke's What I Wouldn't Do. The only job I didn't like, quit after the first shift, was selling subscriptions to TV Guide over the phone. Before that, it was fast food. All the onion rings I could eat, handing sacks of deep-fried burritos through the sliding window, the hungry hands grabbing back. And at the laundromat, plucking bright coins from a palm or pressing them into one, kids screaming from the bathroom and 20 dryers on high. Cleaning houses was fine, polishing the knick-knacks of the rich. I liked holding the hand-blown glass bell from Czechoslovakia up to the light, the jeweled clapper swinging lazily from side to side, its foreign A minor ping. I drifted, an itinerant, from job to job, the sanatorium where I pureed peas and carrots and stringy beets, scooped them like pudding onto flesh-colored plastic plates, or the gas station, where I dipped the 10-foot measuring stick into the hole in the blacktop, pulled it up hand over hand into the twilight, dripping its liquid gold pink-tinged. I liked the donut shop best. 3 a.m., alone in the kitchen, surrounded by sugar and squat mounds of dough. The flashing neon signs strung from wire behind the window, gilding my white uniform, yellow, then blue, then drop-dead red. It wasn't that I hated calling them hour after hour, stuck in a booth with a list of strangers' names, dialing their numbers with the eraser end of a pencil, and them saying hello. It was that moment of expectation, before I answered back, the sound of their held breath, their disappointment when they realized I wasn't who they thought I was, the familiar voice, or the voice they loved and had been waiting all day to hear. Dorian Locke's What I Wouldn't Do. When a poet uses first person as Dorian Locke does, we may be inclined to presume it's autobiographical, and perhaps it is. But it's just as likely the poet uses I to slyly imply what we are reading is all factually true. Dorian Locke uses I 16 times in What I Wouldn't Do, starting in her opening line, the only job I didn't like. We may presume these modern-day jobs were all low-paying, low-status. Yet, for this first-person speaker, many of these jobs held some level of appeal and intrigue. The bulk of the poem presents memorable details that distinguish each job. Details of what she ate, onion rings, what she heard, 20 dryers on high, what she cleaned, the hand-blown glass bell from Czechoslovakia, tasks she performed that relied on muscle memory. Now, in retrospect, She captures each job in concise phrases. A startling recollection of dealing with potential customers appears in the passage about her telemarketing job that frames this poem. Recall the opening sentence. The only job I didn't like, quit after the first shift, was selling subscriptions to TV Guide over the phone. When the poem circles back, finally returns to explain what bothered her about the telemarketer job for TV Guide, the speaker stuns us with her empathy for those on the other end of her line. Again, this is Dorian Lox's What I Wouldn't Do. The only job I didn't like, quit after the first shift, was selling subscriptions to TV Guide over the phone. Before that, it was fast food, all the onion rings I could eat, handing sacks of deep-fried burritos through the sliding window, the hungry hands grabbing back. And at the laundromat, plucking bright coins from a palm or pressing them into one, kids screaming from the bathroom, and 20 dryers on high. Cleaning houses was fine, polishing the knick-knacks of the rich. I liked holding the hand-blown glass bell from Czechoslovakia up to the light, the jeweled clapper swinging lazily from side to side, its foreign A minor ping. I drifted, an itinerant, from job to job, the sanatorium where I pureed peas and carrots and stringy beets, scooped them like pudding onto flesh-colored plastic plates. Or the gas station, where I dipped the 10-foot measuring stick into the hole in the blacktop, pulled it up hand over hand into the twilight, dripping its liquid gold, pink-tinged. I like the donut shop best. 3 a.m., alone in the kitchen, surrounded by sugar and squat mounds of dough, the flashing neon sign strung from wire behind the window, gilding my white uniform yellow, then blue, then drop-dead red. It wasn't that I hated calling them, hour after hour, stuck in a booth with a list of strangers' names, dialing their numbers with the eraser end of a pencil, and them saying hello. It was that moment of expectation before I answered back, the sound of their held breath, their disappointment when they realized I wasn't who they thought I was, the familiar voice, or the voice they loved and have been waiting all day to hear. That's Dorian Lox's What I Wouldn't Do. I love the attitude of the speaker. She's not a whiner. She defines each low-level job with a precise description. That's admirable. And at the close of her poem, the only time she complains, she recognizes she let others down, perhaps lonely, elderly folks for whom their phone was a lifeline to someone they loved. And when Lox's speaker identifies herself, she deflates them. She's merely fishing for TV Guide subscriptions. No wonder she lasted only one day. Curiously, not one phrase refers to a work colleague or boss. Our next two poems feature such interactions. A Working Girl Can't Win. That's the title of Deborah Garrison's 1998 volume of poems. A former senior editor at The New Yorker, Garrison wrote poems, we may presume, set in the offices and occasionally the streets of Manhattan, roughly 25 years ago. In her poem, Superior, Garrison's speaker works on manuscripts. She expresses both a tenacity and dedication to doing right by the authors of the manuscripts in front of her on her desk. Her efforts, though, are ignored by an intrusive colleague. You may be able to relate. If there was that one person you worked with whom you were happy to avoid. In her poem Superior, Garrison depicts a man in a position above the speaker who interrupts her while she's at her desk. Deborah Garrison's poem expresses the annoyance of having to work under a supervisor clueless about office interactions. This is Deborah Garrison's Superior. She came to dread the way he would wander into her office, his eyes flicking over the papers on her desk as though it offended him to have to interrupt tasks that were being done for him, as though the details she was mistress of would needlessly clutter his manager's mind. As he talked of the big picture of who was soon to die and who to win a prize, the pencil she held poised a few inches above the text she'd been correcting when he breezed in, was her only protest. Did it irk him, the way she kept her shoulders slightly rounded over the page, the way the graphite stub in her smudged fingers accused him? Probably not, as he warmed to his speech. He was a thinker aloud, couldn't have a thought unless he spoke it out before an obedient listener. She saw the air thronged with his conceptual offspring. If she didn't keep her slack mouth shut, now he paused, mid-phrase, touching the air with an index finger just where he saw his point appear. She might actually swallow one of his soap bubbles, like a cartoon character sucking her whole 2D world back down. He talked on. She agreed. She agreed. She seconded his thesis, and with each murmured yes, her certainty mounted. She would never be one of them, a director, a manager, an executive thingy. She didn't have the ambition. She was simply a pencil scratching, pausing, picking her way down an obscure page. She liked her fate, but would she be left alone to enjoy it? He hovered there. Couldn't bear to release her, now about to turn and go. But no, he was settling in her single chair and leaning near to confide more fully in her. He talked on, and she agreed with him, perhaps in hopes of speeding up his exit from her office. Although this speaker of Deborah Garrison's poem Superior functions in a lower-level position, and in the course of this intrusive conversation, realizes she will never rise to the level her intruder represents, she's fine with that. As the poem tells us, she liked her fate, but would she be left alone to enjoy it? When we look back at jobs we've held, inevitably, we recall our colleagues who fall into a range from the most supportive to the most obnoxious. Garrison takes us into the interpersonal pressures of office work, the challenges of doing one's job while so many colleagues share the extended space. Though this poem is at least 25 years old now, doesn't it seem safe to say that the sense of annoyance a smart worker feels when intruded upon by a colleague with nothing better to do, whether the colleague is male or female, persists? Is it unlikely that such a scenario will ever change? Let's hear Deborah Garrison's poem again. This is Superior from A Working Girl Can't Win. She came to dread the way he would wander into her office, his eyes flicking over the papers on her desk as though it offended him to have to interrupt tasks that were being done for him, as though the details she was mistress of would needlessly clutter his manager's mind. As he talked of the big picture, of who was soon to die and who to win a prize, the pencil she held poised a few inches above the text she'd been correcting when he breezed in was her only protest. Did it irk him? The way she kept her shoulders slightly rounded over the page, the way the graphite stub in her smudged fingers accused him. Probably not, as he warmed to his speech. He was a thinker aloud, couldn't have a thought unless he spoke it out before an obedient listener. She saw the air thronged with his conceptual offspring. If she didn't keep her slack mouth shut, now he paused, mid-phrase, touching the air with an index finger just where he saw his point appear, she might actually swallow one of his soap bubbles, like a cartoon character sucking her whole 2D world back down. He talked on. She agreed. She agreed. She seconded his thesis. And with each murmured yes, her certainty mounted. She would never be one of them. A director. A manager. An executive thingy. She didn't have the ambition. She was simply a pencil, scratching, pausing, picking her way down an obscure page. She liked her fate, but would she be left alone to enjoy it? He hovered there, couldn't bear to release her, now about to turn and go, but no. He was settling in her single chair and leaning nearer to confide more fully in her. Though I mentioned Garrison's role at the New Yorker, Superior is not written in first person. The speaker refers to she, not I. Perhaps Deborah Garrison does not want to imply this situation is strictly autobiographical. Instead, it's all too common in office settings, with a male manager oblivious to a female employee. Though it's not simply the gender distinction highlighted in this poem, there's an office hierarchy in play. The speaker admits she would never be one of them, a director, a manager, an executive thingy. She didn't have the ambition. She knows what tasks she handles with skill. She aspires to be left alone to complete those tasks. And consider that label, an executive thingy. With her sarcastic take on titles that sound impressive and vague, Garrison's speaker punctures the pretentiousness of the titles held by those in positions above her. Our third poem features an interaction between a 25-year-old speaker and his boss. The location? A company that markets snack foods. The poem summarizes the exchange between these two men, but the poem's tension emerges when the speaker realizes he does not want to do what he just told his boss he would do. The heart of the poem is the speaker's sudden revelation about what he values, or at least what he does not value. This is Stephen Dunn's poem, The Last Hours. There's some innocence left, and these are the last hours of an empty afternoon at the office. And there's the clock on the wall, and my friend Frank in the adjacent cubicle selling himself on the phone. I'm 25, on the shaky ladder up, my father's son, corporate, clean-shaven, and I know only what I don't want, which is almost everything I have. A meeting ends. Men in serious suits, intelligent men who've been thinking hard about marketing snacks, move back now to their window offices, worried or proud. The big boss, Horace, had called them in to approve this, reject that. The big boss, a first name, how's your family kind of assassin? Who likes me? It's 1964. The 60s haven't begun yet. Cuba is a larger name than Vietnam. The Soviets are behind everything that could be wrong. Where I sit, it's exactly 19 minutes to 5. My phone rings. Horace would like me to stop in before I leave. Stop in. code words, leisurely words, that mean now. Would I be willing to take on this? Would X's office, who, by the way, is no longer with us, be satisfactory? About money? Will this be enough? I smile. I say, yes, and yes, and yes. But I don't know from what calm place this comes. I'm translating his beneficence into a lifetime, a life of selling snacks, talking snack strategy, thinking snack thoughts. On the elevator down, it's a small knot, I'd like to say, of joy. That's how I tell it now, here in the future, the fear long gone. By the time I reach the subway, it's grown, it's outsized, an attitude finally come round, and I say it quietly to myself, I quit. And keep saying it, knowing I will say it, sure of nothing else but. Stephen Dunn's The Last Hours. Stephen Dunn uses I 16 times in The Last Hours. Weirdly, the same number of times Dorian Locks uses I in What I Wouldn't Do. It's true that Dunn worked in the National Biscuit Company as a young man, so we may presume the situation outlined here is autobiographical. He was offered a promotion, accepted, and yet feeling unsatisfied with his corporate identity, fearful of how he might soon settle into a comfortable life promoting snacks, he self-corrects, decides he was wrong to accept Horace's offer. His boss values the speaker's work and has confidence in him. But within minutes of saying yes to Horace's offer, he silently determines he will refuse it. The first-person speaker implies that the way he describes the last hours at this job may not be precisely the way he felt at that time. Near the poem's end, he admits, on the elevator down, it's a small knot, I'd like to say, of joy. That's how I tell it now, here in the future, the fear long gone. The poem does not address the fear he must feel soon. He will have to explain to Horace he doesn't want the promotion, the new office, the raise, or even to work in the snack industry anymore. And, let's presume, a fear of what he will do when he cleans out his desk and sets out on his own. This 25-year-old guy is leaving a secure position and venturing into what might be an uncomfortable, extended period of uncertainty. Let's hear Stephen Dunn's The Last Hours once more. There's some innocence left, and these are the last hours of an empty afternoon at the office. And there's the clock on the wall, and my friend Frank in the adjacent cubicle selling himself on the phone. I'm 25, on the shaky ladder up, my father's son, corporate, clean-shaven, and I know only what I don't want, which is almost everything I have. A meeting ends. Men in serious suits, intelligent men, who've been thinking hard about marketing snacks, move back now to their window offices, worried or proud. The big boss, Horace, had called them in to approve this, reject that. The big boss, a first name, how's your family kind of assassin, who likes me. It's 1964. The 60s haven't begun yet. Cuba is a larger name than Vietnam. The Soviets are behind everything that could be wrong. Where I sit, it's exactly 19 minutes to 5. My phone rings. Horace would like me to stop in before I leave. Stop in. Code words. Leisurely words that mean now. Would I be willing to take on this? Would X's office, who, by the way, is no longer with us, be satisfactory? About money? Will this be enough? I smile. I say yes, and yes, and yes. But I don't know from what calm place this comes. I'm translating his beneficence into a lifetime, a life of selling snacks, talking snack strategy, thinking snack thoughts. On the elevator down, it's a small knot, I'd like to say, of joy. That's how I tell it now, here in the future, the fear long gone. By the time I reach the subway, it's grown. It's outsized, an attitude finally come round, and I say it quietly to myself, I quit. And I keep saying it, knowing I will say it, sure of nothing else but. Stephen Dunn's The Last Hours. On the previous episode of Poems for Company, I read about a grass mower hired by old women. I read about an Irish Thatcher from 70 years ago, and a London street from over 200 years ago, crowded with chimney boys, knife grinders, and others. And from today's episode, a phone solicitor who lasted 1 day on the job, a copy editor distracted by her superior, and a snack marketer. You may listen to any episode of the show whenever you like. Go to KMUN.org and follow these three quick steps. Click on Programming, then click on the Podcast tab, and finally click on Poems for Company. There, you will find a credit list of all poems read on the show. This show is available now on most apps, such as Spotify and Pandora. Search either by title, Poems for Company, or by KMUN. If you have any suggestions, corrections, questions, please contact me, Brian Dillon, at feedback@kmun.org. Our theme music is Philip Auberg's Going to the Sun from his CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening.